Hello and welcome to the Week at Work. My name's Claire O'Connor. I'm joined this week by fellow Left Bloc member Lorna Bogue, who's also a Green Left City Councillor for Cork City. Lorna, it's been a busy week this week, and I think we're probably going to start the same way we always start, which is on housing, because it's just been the predominant issue for the last, well, couple of years. I was going to say a couple of months, but a couple of years. But what kind of story, what stories jumped out to you this week the most in terms of housing?
Well, there are a few of them that have kind of cropped up for me. And I suppose I picked out these stories because they just go to show the way that the government goes about things, which, full disclosure, I think is stupid. I'm only saying this because, like, honestly, the lifting of the eviction ban, and I'm sure any councillor in the country will tell you, this has just been an unrelenting nightmare. Like, for since it has been announced, since it has actually happened, it has just been a nightmare. And some of my other fellow candidates, where we have discussed this issue, like, have spoken about feeling burnt out. Our own housing staff are, doing Trojan work. They're kind of answering emails still at 11, 12 in the evening. We would sometimes get replies to things. They're pulling out all the stops. But there is nothing coming from the government in terms of support or anything to actually back up what they have done here. So I picked a story by Cillian Woods in the Sunday Business Post, and it's the state's land development agency could be hit with multi-million hoarding taxes. And I found the story kind of interesting because obviously the land development agency, is getting hit with this anti-land speculation tax, even though, like, the government set that up specifically not to do that, and yet the outworkings of how the LDA has been functioning has, in a sense, been to take public land and essentially privatize it and increase the value of it through planning permissions that don't actually get followed through on with construction. So, I mean, they're acting in much the same way as any as any developer is, which is just to valorize the land. It's not to produce housing. And they don't really seem to be operating with any kind of a social purpose. On the one hand, I'm kind of like, yeah, tax them, like they should be taxed, but on the other hand, it kind of reminds me of the fact that like when it comes to other taxes, like Cork City Council, for example, pays property taxes on social housing that it owns. So we are giving money to the government to have it given back to us, and these are social housing, it kind of just outlines, like, the lack of social purpose to any of Ireland's housing policy. There's no social purpose to it.
Yeah. And the LDA was, going back to, there's been so many instances, but going back to even the likes of O'Devenly Gardens up in Dublin, like, councillors are basically being threatened with the LDA. If you don't vote for this really bad deal, which is essentially privatising public land and allowing a private developer to come in and make massive profits off a deal that could have been done in so many different ways. There was co-ops that, there was smaller construction companies. There was obviously state building that could have been done, that the procurement process essentially cut out. So there's a really good Gwaelon Developments up in Ballymun wanted to be a part of that process, but basically the procurement process cut them out because you had to have a high enough turnover to even engage in that. So it was making it so that only highly successful private developers could engage in it. But essentially what happened was when the city council almost unanimously wanted to oppose it, they were threatened with, well, we'll just give it to the LDA. If you don't do this, nothing's going to happen for a certain amount of time. We'll give it to the LDA and it'll be an even worse deal in terms of public and social housing. And I mean, the fact that that was being used just shows you how poor that social purpose is in the LDA. Because ideally, you'd imagine in a situation like that, the councillor should have been in a position to say, okay, well, let's give it to the LDA and the LDA will make it a proper public housing development.
Yes.
But
Yeah.
it's like, the logic to it is just it's madness. And I mean, we're not surprised by this. This is how the state works, and it has all, it's almost come out of the whole idea of public private partnership, but it's gone to the other extreme. It's like the state has completely abdicated responsibility and said, I mean, one of the excuses that is genuinely given, particularly in council, and like the thing is, I don't think council are given enough responsibility or resource realistically. And I think what happens is, particularly senior officials, then they know the limitations positions within the council. So they're very risk averse then as well. So it's like, well, we don't have the resources or the staff, and we can't pay the kind of salaries that the likes of the private developers are paying in terms of, you know, the senior staff within their organization. So they basically say, like, we don't have the capacity to do this. And it's like, why can't we just develop a model that is similar to the private companies in terms of their staff and in terms of the people that they're employing? I mean, those people are obviously in the country. Like, we keep hearing how we don't have enough kind of construction and labor staff. But if a private developer can get them, the state should be able to get them. You know, and the thing is that if we were able to do that and cut out the profit piece, still be saving hundreds of millions. So yeah, it is extremely frustrating, man, to see that. And then you look at, like, I mean, there's so many different housing stories this week. Another one is, I know you were touching on it in terms of only 7 new sites for emergency accommodation for refugees were sourced. Same Killian Woods again, isn't it?
Yeah, no, he's great. Amazing. I suppose, yeah. One final thing, maybe just to add to the previous story, because it made me laugh in a very hollow and bitter kind of way. But so private developers have gotten exemptions to this tax from Cork City Council. I'm laughing and smiling, but I'm not happy.
We're actually going to tax ourselves now and not tax private developers.
Oh yeah, no. Well, you see, this is it. You know, like it's amazing. Like, and the way that the Irish state makes rules is very much, you know, like
pick and mix.
Well, it's like the grammatical rules of Irish. You know, for every rule, there's about 17 million exceptions to it. You know, yeah. So I just thought I'd point that out because that was quite funny, really, in a raging way. To come back to the other story, which was there's only 7 new sites sourced for emergency refugee accommodation. So I suppose this is a story about housing, but it is also a story about outsourcing care of vulnerable people to private actors and private agents. So in this particular story, the modular housing, it seems, has ground to a halt. We had modular housing in my ward, actually. That dealing with the department on that was just a total disaster from start to finish, because the department itself is under-resourced. So they don't have enough staff to actually do the things that they promised that they're doing. They go out in the media and make a big, you know, pat on the back ceremony about how brilliant and generous and kind they are being. And then in terms of public provision of housing for not just Ukrainian refugees, by the way, I mean like other refugees and asylum seekers in the Irish state, there's no action behind it. And now it seems in this story that, you know, only 7 new sites sourced for emergency refugee accommodation. But you see, the thing is that these are private sites, private facilities, privately owned buildings. And what I find interesting is that when you look at who is actually the owners of these sites, who are kind of coming forward with them, like they're all holdings companies, ventures companies, you know, so they're investment funds. And what they're relying on here is that they give substandard buildings to the Irish state to house refugees in. Same as the direct provision system, by the way. You know, that was a bailout for failed hoteliers, you know, people who built Celtic Tiger hotels in the back arse of nowhere needed a bailout from the state, you know. And the state basically gives them a bailout in the form of putting vulnerable people in inappropriate care. You know, same is now and forever shall be. That is what the state has always actually done, is outsource the care of vulnerable groups and people to, private operators. And in this case, you know, it's ventures, it's holdings, like it's companies like this.
Private investment.
Oh yeah, exactly. And that to me again is just, you know, it is not possible for the Irish state to have, you know, good policies in this regard, because again, their policies when it comes to housing, health, you know, looking after vulnerable groups, there's no social policy, you know, there's no social reason for doing things. Yeah. It's always just like, we have a bunch of people here with, you know, needs. How do we make a quick buck off it? How do our bodies make a quick buck, you know?
And how, that's it. Every crisis is an opportunity for profit. Like, that's what's been shown here time and time again. And the Irish Times actually have an article on it as well. And you know what I find? When I saw this, I was on the Tonight Show a couple of weeks ago where Neil Richmond was one of the panelists, and I was just thrown out all of these different options that could have been brought in earlier to prevent things getting so bad. And it was just one of many, because I don't particularly think modular homes, you know, it's not like we're all out there advocating for modular homes to be the answer to people's public housing situation.
No, it's an emergency.
Yeah. And when you have people literally sleeping in sleeping bags in community centre halls, you know, modular homes are an option. But I had said to him, and he was so, you know, like angry, and turned around and was so dismissive and was just like, modular, what are you talking about? Modular homes, we have ordered modular homes. Modular homes are on their way. And I didn't have the time to get into how these were like a year too late. People were asking for this for like a year and a half in terms of, they only ordered them in December. And that's, they don't have the sites.
Well, we were supposed to have that in November, you see. So
yeah, like, okay. That's what they do. And it's also that we just have such low standards and low expectations, because they've just been so consistently bad across everything. And it's this thing about, you know, like, it also is like, they know that they can get away with it. And because there is so many emergencies at the minute, things are so bad that they can get away with treating people worse. And they're like, well, we have to accept this because there's no other options. They're using the war, you know, they're using the Ukrainian war as a this extraordinary event, as if we haven't had a housing crisis for over 8 years, like an extreme housing crisis for over 8 years.
And that was said in one of our meetings about it. So we had a special meeting about the housing crisis, not in public, of course, because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael and Green Party members of government parties don't want us actually in councils to openly discuss the politics of this. But anyway, we had a privately held meeting about what was going on. And what our housing staff were saying to us was basically, look, yes, this is an emergency, but we have been dealing with a housing emergency since 2016, you know. So actually, you know, like, you councillors feel reassured. And I was like, this is not reassuring. This is actually very bad.
Yeah.
But you're right, Claire. Like, it's always the next crisis, the next emergency. Yeah. And we the people should actually just memory hole everything that has come before, or the reasons for why this has happened, you know. Yeah. And, you know, sorry, it's an emergency. We have to do something now. Like, where who's offering solutions? And if you say, well, I have solutions, then they're just kind of like, no, I didn't hear that.
Yeah. Well, instead, what they do is they job was, I mean, I Micheál Martin was on the Talking Bollocks podcast this week. And when he was asked, you know, why we have a housing crisis, his answer was an increase in population. Now, he's gone back to an increase in population in decades. And there was any steam coming out of my ears when I heard that, because, I mean, we don't need to get into all the myriad of reasons why that's such an issue. Like, another one, Killian Woods had an article last week actually as well, where he was going through the fact that, you know, we can't, and maybe you shared this article with me actually, you know, we can't fix what we can't measure. You know, and he was talking about all the different issues in how we measure our statistics. And that's been an ongoing thing. Like, we used to talk about that years ago in terms of when the figures would come out around, you know, homeless figures every month. But one thing that really struck me was, I think it was 497 social homes were sold to tenants last year. And I didn't realise that scheme was still in place and actually still so popular. And it's like, not only are we not bringing enough social and public, you know, council house in on stream, whether that's building, which is obviously the priority, but then also, you know, acquisition, buying them back, you know, doing up dilapidated and abandoned homes, that kind of thing. We also now are selling them again. So we're going to just, like, we're probably selling them at a quicker rate than we are even bringing them back on stream. And it's, again, it's that idea that housing, private housing and home ownership is the preferred model, that there is a little bit of a classism to it. There's a classism to everything, obviously, but it's that home ownership is seen as preferential, and it's seen as the ideal. And to be honest, in this country, you can totally understand why that would be, because of the lack of security of tenure, home ownership feels to a lot of people like the only way they're going to get that. But that is actually just speaks to how poor our housing system is.
In social housing, I would say that it is probably more the case that the tenure is secure, but in in terms of getting us as landlords to maintain anything. Good luck. You know, because we the council doesn't put the requisite funding or staffing levels into the amount of maintenance that is required. I mean, like, it's interesting that, you know, like, I just find it interesting that councils don't tend to think of themselves as landlords, but we are as well. We're better landlords than most out there. However, there are failings as well, like in terms of turning over our stock, in terms of, maintaining it, in terms of doing the things that you should be able to ask a landlord to do. I can see why people would feel the need to buy their way out of that. But the answer to that isn't to allow them. It's actually for us to kind of step up. Suppose this week, what I sort of said in council was, because we have a housing stock of over 8,000 units in Cork City, that, you know, the government has brought in an eviction ban. But maybe we as a landlord ourselves would say, right, well, we're not listening to you, actually. So we will bring in an eviction ban ourselves on our own housing. So I think that might be, I'm hopeful that something like that will go through. But I think it might be a good thing for other councils to do, actually, for us as a market actor, in a sense.
But also, council housing has been very typically stable. Like, it has been the most stable. That's why a lot of people are on housing lists. And the problem is that increasingly we've actually moved away from a landlord type state landlord council housing system, because we now have AHBs stepping into that market who are much quicker to evict. Their policies aren't the same as a council. It's not seen as a lifelong house. We also have, you know, the leasing with private landlords. So they were actually leasing council homes for 20 years of private landlords. So again, they're not council owned or council managed properties. So even when people, you know, are housed by the council, it's kind of decreasing all the time in terms of the percentage of that are actually, you know, have the landlord or have the state as a landlord. It's all just back to the privatisation. And then one last thing on housing as well is that, like, and nearly every, in fairness, you know, like the Irish Times, RTE, the Independent, the Journal, almost everywhere did cover it. And it's about the underspend on housing, the almost 1.5 billion basically between 2020 and 2022. And in fairness, even opposition politicians and some people have acknowledged that there's going to be an underspend through COVID because construction was halted. But the level of this underspend is so extreme and also disproportionate. So like there's 1 billion that is social homes, and then it's like, you know, 400 million relates to the private schemes, which is massive. And it's also, when you talk about the COVID reason, even into this year, into 2023, I think it was the quarter one up to the end of March, I think we're still, it's like 27 or 29% under target. So it's a consistent, and like our targets are not high enough, as we know. And that just all comes back to the fact that the policy is steeped in neoliberal thinking. It's steeped in, you know, relying on the private sector. And we're never going to deliver when we're coming from a starting place of a policy that doesn't make sense.
No, that's it. And it's I think in terms of like how people who are into politics kind of engage with this issue, like there is something that seriously has to be politicized about that, because, you know, I go into council meetings, and like we had a meeting this week where we had an hour-long discussion at the start of the meeting about the previous lack of rules and procedures being followed at the last meeting. So it was a meeting about a meeting. This meeting, by the way, went on for like 5 hours. What happened then was Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party, all of them stood up and sort of basically either pretended that the eviction ban being lifted was something that just fell out of the sky, you know, who has done this, you know, which is kind of like, okay, the fact that you feel that you can actually stand up in a room full of people and say this, and that there hasn't actually been a housing crisis, you know, things have been going quite well, actually. And then, you know, okay, well, maybe we can accept that there's a little teeny tiny problem with this lifting of the eviction ban, but, you know, the government has come in with lots of like really good schemes. And it's the same answer every time that they give. So there's a politicization of this that has to happen, which is basically for people who require housing, i.e., you know, workers and carers, like that we are saying, actually, sorry, you know, this is not acceptable anymore. You know, that's it. Like, this is just not happening.
And political education, again, we talk about it all the time, but grassroots community political education, I think, is one of the only ways things are really going to change, because unfortunately so much of what the government says and what politicians in government say is just not true or not representative. It's a fraction, like Neil Richmond saying, we have modular homes coming, and you don't have the time to sit and explain, well, actually, no, you were a year late to even order them. You know they're not coming from down the line. You haven't secured the land. The land you have secured is actually a private model that's going to result in substandard care and accommodation, increased spending. And, you know, like one of millions of issues. You don't have the time to really go into in-depth with people at home and say, look at all these issues here. Look at the lies and look at where it's got. We need people to be able to hear that. Like, not everybody has the time or the inclination to be, you know, in this day in, day out, and, you know, having the time to break down and analyze everything they're saying and find out what's true and what's not true. So finding a way for people to just understand where they're lying, what the root of the issue is, the privatization, and hopefully then not get so kind of disengage and not get so fed up of it, because I totally understand why people disengage. Because when you see that all the time, and when you see promises that don't materialize in your life, your quality of life is, you know, so poor, when you see that there's money around, I think it's that grassroots political education.
Well, it's class politics, you know. Yeah. I mean, like, at the end of the day, it shouldn't really matter what comes out of the mouth of any Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael or Green Party politician. And I will extend that perhaps to other parties, but I don't want to get in trouble. But you know, to take a simple example, like these are government party politicians. So who do they represent? Well, they represent the rich. That's it, you know. And so anything that comes out of their mouth is a lie. Any concern, any kind of this is unforeseen circumstances, you know, the housing policy, we had the best of intentions, but, you know, it's just turned into a big mess that is not working. And you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party, their policies are working perfectly, because for the people who they represent, which is the rich, the house prices keep going up, the rent keeps going up, the land prices keep going up, and then government services, so the things that people need, are handed over then to their rich bodies. So it's actually very simple. I think we are told a lot of the time that all of this stuff is really kind of complex.
Yeah.
But actually it's very simple. And I suppose, you know, we all actually have an awareness of this, but it takes a bit of, I find that it comes out when I'm canvassing. So if I'm talking to someone one-on-one about these, I sort of would say, you know, well, what do you do? Like, what's your normal kind of day look like? You know, who are you working for? Or, you know, who is benefiting from, you know, your normal day-to-day life? So you, and, you know, people generally are kind of like, you know, they're workers, they're carers, they're workers and carers. You know, you don't need to be, you know, like I generally would say workers and carers, actually, because you know, somebody who is at home looking after someone else is
a carer,
doing you know, like and it's just kind of like, you know, so you do this, you work as a cleaner, so you go out clean, and, you know, so, you know, you're working as an agency worker for a management company. So they have a contract with whichever institution, whichever place you are cleaning. And they are getting money on the basis that they have hired you to clean. So who is actually making the money out of your work? Well, it's this, you know, massive multinational conglomerate company, and then they don't pay taxes, you know. So who has created this situation? And the answer to that question is not refugees or whichever other group we're all against today. You know, it's rich people. And the politicians are acting for the rich people. You know,
so I think where people find, I think where I do think a lot of people get that and understand it, but where the block is, they don't see or know what the alternative is. And I find when I'm talking to people, particularly lately, and particularly since I got involved in Left Block, what I've started to talk about is local community wealth building, because, and, you know, the whole, you know, the the phrase, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. People genuinely can't imagine, like, well, what's the alternative? Like, how do we actually change things? And that's why I think social democracy is seen as such an attractive option for a lot of people, because they think, well, just a little. I remember thinking like that, you know, years ago, like, just better than this is better. Like, we just need, I mean, we need people need some more, you know, they need a little bit more quality of life, rather than realizing that this system is never going to provide for us. It is literally built to fail us. And but when I talk to people about the likes of Trademark and all the co-ops that they all work under, and you know, if anybody's interested in finding out a little bit more about community wealth building, Trademark Belfast have a couple of podcasts on it, and Joe Guinan has written a book, and Miriam Brett, and there's a lot of people kind of talking and writing about it. But it's basically like workers coming together and sharing in the fruits of their labor, you know, like, so it not you know, 90% of, you know, what their labor produces being taken away and put into, you know, a handful of people's pockets, that they actually get to share, and it benefits the community, it benefits them, gives more people opportunity. And that, I find when I talk to people about that, they're like, well, that seems possible. And then they're a little bit more engaged, and they're like, that's something that I could actually see happening. You know, national and international kind of structural system change is just too much for people sometimes. But yeah, when you talk about it on that level, it's like, okay, well, I can imagine that now. And now they find they can engage a little bit more again.
Well, you see, that idea of workers having a share, you know, to extend beyond that, and I'm sure you agree with me anyway, but you know, workers deciding, actually, yeah
yeah, sorry, like that. So that's a room. I was like, yeah, no, I'm like, yes. I'll send people over to Trademark to listen to that rather than me going on about it. But like, workers essentially democratically deciding on how the co-op works and how they engage with their work and how everything is organized, and like, it's a completely democratic structure. I suppose it's just back to that piece about, because sometimes I think what people really, I think even when you talk to people about democratically organizing your workplace, they might think of unions, but they might think somebody going to somebody else and somebody else organizing that. So I think it might take time for people to really understand what's possible in terms of a group of people coming together and having genuinely equal share and equal say. And what happens, that's such a foreign concept to people, because it's so far from what we have and so far from the norm, and we've been born into this system of capitalism. And I just think that that's such a hurdle, and even that alone, putting it into people's mindsets, just the imagination to know what's possible, I think is radical. I think that's actually radical, and that's really where the change will come from.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, when I'm thinking about things like this, I know that there's lots of different kind of, you know, there's lots of different pathways that people can take. So, you know, you like cooperatives, other people like other types of structures, you know.
Yeah.
So I think really it's actually about opening pathways to even thinking about what is possible. Because I find when I'm talking to people, you know, they might say something about their work issues. So for example, like someone who's an SNA and is spread across loads of different schools, and also, you know, has their own kind of practice where people are being sent from different towns very far away in order to get their hours, you know. And like what they would say, you know, or well, in this example, like one particular person I was talking to, was, well, if I could actually group things, then that means that there'd be less traveling for everyone involved. And this would be just a much more efficient way of doing things. But there's too much red tape. I'm not allowed to do that. I have to do it in this really kind of, you know, not efficient kind of way. And of course, the inefficiency is actually coming from, you know, well, we as the state have to provide a sort of basically barely running service. And if people end up going into the private sector as a result of that, oh no, like somebody's going to make a profit. Like, oh, this is so and also, bad. How is
it
this
won't be our responsibility
happened?
Then.
Again.
But also then it won't be their responsibility, because once they outsource, if there's a failure, oh, well, we outsourced that company and that company has failed. It's, I think we could do a whole podcast on this, and I think we should again. Yeah. But I think in terms of, I know you had another story you wanted to cover in terms of kind of climate and environmental stuff. It was the, go on, jump in there.
Well, I had two actually, because I suppose the, I'm not going to say this right, Clima Senioren, and so Senior Women for Climate, they're a group of Swiss older women, and they've taken a case to the European Court of Human Rights. And basically, I suppose, as a result of that, You know, it's up to individual kind of member states how they choose to represent themselves. So pretty much every state apart from two, and you have no points for guessing who one of them is, basically just sort of, you know, sent in their kind of submissions or whatever. Ireland, on the other hand, number one climate laggard in the European Union, with the number one climate laggard minister in the European Union, sent loads of lawyers to give a verbal presentation, which was basically to argue that the human rights of these women, which were to do with health, actually, is to do with, you know, heat waves would make it very difficult for us as older women, you know, et cetera, et cetera, which is, you know, true. Actually, more people die in heat waves, and older people particularly are adversely affected by that. Was basically just to say that, like, the right to a clean, healthy environment isn't actually a right that you have, like, or something to that effect. Anyway, I can't.
I can't remember
because a red mist came down when I was reading this, so I couldn't remember precisely what their argument is, but I thought it was stupid.
I have the Independent in front of me, and John Gibbons wrote, I think, in the Examiner. And so Ireland argues the European Convention on Human Rights, which the court has set up to uphold, does not guarantee the right to a clean, healthy and sustainable environment. I mean, this was not our business. This was not, you know, this was a Swiss case, and Ireland sent a team of lawyers to make a verbal argument that actually we do not have those rights. Those, they went and argued against our human rights. I mean, it's
not just
outrageous.
Ireland, by the way. I mean, like the cabinet, and the department themselves, the Department of the Environment, or climate, or whatever it's called, they made a decision. The minister made a decision to do that. That is what happened.
Like, it's outrageous. And you have to, like, if we, you know, again, if we had the time, we won't. Like, but if you had the time to really go into why would they do that? Why is it in their interest to do that? At its most basic, it's because they know we as a country are not upheld, and they're not upheld in our rights to those things. And they don't want to be in a position where we can take cases against. Like, that's ultimately it.
Well, I suppose it goes back to, you know, because there's a series of climate cases, you know, and one particular case was the Urgenda case, which was in the Netherlands, and basically citizens there were like, look, these carbon emissions reduction targets, you have to actually do this, you know, you've made commitments on climate, you have to do it. And as a result of that, some industries in the Netherlands, such as cheese processing and dairy, ended up being displaced. And where do these things get displaced to? Well, they get displaced to a country on the edge of Europe that doesn't like rules or regulation, and indeed will fight tooth and nail to allow themselves to continue to not be regulated in this way. And that country is Ireland Incorporated. And the thing about it is that what we are seeing now in the state fighting so vociferously against any kind of commitment to climate, which of course means reduction in carbon emissions, a decarbonisation. What we see is the thing that they are fighting for is not simply to, you know, ruin people's lives. They don't really care about us or about climate. But it is, we've done the tax haven thing where we sell out our lack of regulation and we allow a huge common public bad to happen. We facilitate that. We facilitate the money of the world just running around and being directed towards profit rather than being taxed fairly. So we have done that tax haven model. You know, it's really worked well. We see now that carbon is something that's, you know, a lot of people are supposed to reduce. They're supposed to reduce that. So there's just a little kind of the same little neoliberal brainworms that produce the tax haven have produced the carbon haven. And Minister Eamon Ryan is setting up the Irish state as a carbon haven. So it's not just that the Green Party went into government and they broke lots of promises and we're all really sad about that. It's no, they have and are going to cause massive international climate damage. That is what they are doing here. That is what they are setting up Irish state for. So again, it's a political question. It's something that needs to be politicized. You know, we all as people, not just in Ireland but around the world, as workers and carers, we care about there being a habitable planet for us to live on. We don't want to experience food shortages. We don't want to experience extreme temperatures. You know, so it is in our interest and only our interest that this is stopped. And it is for our children and our grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera. But it is about us as a class. Like, climate is a worker's issue. It's a carer's issue. It's about us as a class. Meanwhile, rich just want profit, and the world can burn as far as they're concerned, because they don't care. And they're short-term thinkers. They have no need to actually.
They'll have the money to defend themselves from a certain amount of this in a way most of us could never imagine as well. I really like the way you linked, though, the tax evasion and us, basically, because when our tax evasion doesn't just affect us in terms of we're not getting the tax income into the company. We are facilitating the tax evasion of companies all over Europe. And not only Europe, like we're stealing. We're actually facilitating the theft of what could be public money in these countries. And we're doing a similar thing in terms of the carbon hoarding and the setting us up as this. Like, we're actually, particularly with data centers, but we're facilitating in negative climate outcomes for the rest of the world and the rest of Europe and what we're doing. And to think that it's a green, supposedly green minister, someone like Eamon Ryan, who's actually facilitating this and creating this, is mind blown.
Well, I mean, that's, it's not really mind blown though. That is why he's there, because he to them is a useful idiot. You know,
exactly.
So you know, that is what he is. That is the function that he plays.
Yeah.
Because I had another story that kind of made me sort of link these things together. And it was from the Irish Farmers Journal. And it's something that Minister Simon Coveney was saying to farmers and dairy co-op, and it was about, you know, the makeup of the Irish economy, and basically the headline of it is dairy is contributing more than tech hub, from says Simon Cove. So he has backed Irish dairy this week as he insisted it contributes more to the economy than foreign direct investment. Now, he's in a sense not wrong, because he is actually signalling the policy direction here, because that the 15% tax has come in on Apple, Microsoft, all of those come. And the tax take is increasing exponentially as a result of that here. Now, the thing about that is, and this was also a story, I think, on the front page of the Sunday Business Post as well. I'm an SPP girl, you know. Killian Woods, come on the show. it's that the tax take has increased in terms of absolute amount. However, the number of companies that are making up the vast majority of the tax take is getting smaller and smaller all the time. And that is something that government economists in various reports, the EU as well, has warned Ireland about. Because you see, if any single one of these companies pulls out now, that's going to be a big problem. I suppose capitalists in Ireland recognize that this might be a problem. When I say capitalists in Ireland, I mean like the ruling class here, like the national bourgeoisie, our own homegrown, you know, cringe, the people who have done well for themselves, you know. Yeah. So the Irish state, the political class, has a problem. And the problem is, if this tax haven model goes slap bang wallop, that would be bad, you know. That would be bad for us, because the gravy train kind of is over then.
I do think a lot of them, particularly like, you know, the finance bros, they argue so much to keep our corporation tax low, because they said, well, this is what will happen. You know, people, so I think even going up to 15%, and let's be honest, we know it's nowhere near 15% what they're actually paying because of all the loopholes, that they'll to do is say, we told you this would happen, we never should have raised it, we should have kept them here, it was worth more in the long run. And they, I think they have themselves covered no matter what
happens. Oh yeah, well that's true as well, but I suppose in this regard, you know, there's lots of other kind of countries that do the tax haven thing as well. They need to innovate into something else. And I suppose the thing about it is that there's quite little industry here, really. So it's a very specific thing that they have done now, which is kind of a agriculturally facing thing. But the employment the employment is actually more in the processors than anywhere else. And the people who are working for the processors, so as in the abattoirs, the food processors, all of that kind of end of things. These are vulnerable migrant workers as well. Like we saw this during COVID, you know, like that
the meat factories, they were
screwed, you know?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, no, 100%. I almost don't want to talk about the Biden visit just because it has been absolutely wall to wall everywhere in a way that I didn't watch the vast majority of it. You couldn't, but it was pushing their faces so much. So one thing I found so difficult was I did see, you know, the clip of him coming into the Dáil and everybody's clapping, which is, you know, what you'd expect, and fair play to PPP for not attending, because they basically weren't, he was treated different to any other world leader that's attended, and that no statements were able to be given to him. So PPP stayed out of the chamber and they protested. But the whooping, there was whooping and cheering, and I just, for so many reasons, I mean, and having the United States and peace mentioned in the same sentence, as if they're not the most imperialist country in the world and haven't caused untold, you know, death and suffering and profiteering from the war industry around the world. But, I want to talk about it more so in the context of neutrality, because the neutrality conversation has been raging for a while, but we've seen in the past couple of weeks that the government have announced not a citizens' assembly, not a referendum, but I can't remember how they framed it, but basically they will take public submissions. So they're going to have a conversation about neutrality and they'll take submissions on it. So, which I find very concerning, because I find that why, when we have all these mechanisms to have truly representative, you know, democratic process, the only reason they would do a process like this is actually to avoid, they know what the will of the people is. We know the majority of people, poll after poll after poll shows that Irish people support neutrality. And they're doing everything they can, the propaganda in trying to, like in some of the papers this week, sorry, they had articles from people from across the world talking about and criticizing Ireland and basically saying that we're not paying our dues, we're not playing our part in world peace. And there just doesn't seem to be any acknowledgement in that about that the place Ireland has within conversations around peace is actually that we are one of very few countries in the world, or we were one of very few countries in the world that could actually be a peace negotiator. We could actually go in as a neutral country, because when talks come, and they have to come, if you don't have peace talks, war rages on. Like that's the reality, or else you have extractions from war which are incredibly exploitative and just absolutely leave countries decimated. There has to be, you know, a facility for peace, and we could have been that. We can't be that now for between Ukraine and Russia, you know, aside from our own stance and political stance we take on neutrality. Like our neutrality has been eroded in this, you know, we've been aligned with NATO and with America, even more so than Ukraine, like NATO and America, in so many ways by so many of our politicians, that there's no way Russia would accept us in a you know, peace negotiation. So yeah, in terms of the Biden visit, and particularly around neutrality, but also just in some of the stuff that's happened over the last, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Lula has actually been saying some good things around it. He's been keeping a level head on it. But I mean, it's I suppose to start off with where you began, which is, you know, there's going to be a citizens assembly slash not really a citizens assembly slash some kind of weird thing that kind of sounds like that but isn't. I mean, like the government has been having a really good time with things that sound like citizens' assemblies lately, because I mean, like the one on drugs now seems already off to an extreme.
I was going to touch on that.
It's the same mechanic, you know. It's but we are asking you what you think. I mean, like in terms of the government's drive to join NATO, etc., etc. Like, you know, I actually have a lot of people in the Navy and probably in the military as well in my constituency. And the problem that those people have and their families have is that they are terribly underpaid, to the point where there are, you know, naval vessels sitting, not able to actually go out or do anything because they can't find the staff to do it. So the Irish state then seems to be trying to, I suppose, signal willingness to be a part of the club. But in terms of what they can actually contribute, I would say that it is an army and a navy that has been run down over years and years of poor pay. So what is actually being agreed?
I don't think it's even that.
Here,
like. You know, like to join NATO, we would have to massively increase our spending on our military spending. And the thing is that wouldn't necessarily go to our armed forces, you know, like our military and navy and defense forces, more so than even, you know, armed forces probably isn't the right word, but like I don't think they're interested really in our actual forces. Although down the line it would be, you know, it would be young people in this country that are being sucked in, because as we see it over in America, what happens is when it does become financially a little bit more attractive when people are living in poverty, that's a really dangerous place to get into as well. And I think that they're exploiting the fact that they have underpaid, you know, Army and Navy members here for so long, and their conditions have been so bad for so long. And they're trying to insinuate that, oh, well, if we join NATO, that will change. They don't need to join NATO. We don't need to join NATO to pay people correct. You know, we don't need to join NATO to give people a living wage. Like, and it's, I feel like it's just a really manipulative, calculated exploitation again of our government have created this problem. They're leaving people in poverty. They're not funding our own service. And yeah, we will, a huge amount of the money that we'll have to pay if we did join NATO would have to go elsewhere. It wouldn't actually be, it wouldn't be investment in this country. So yeah, I also do think, I think that because of the media kind of bombardment, I do feel like if the longer this goes on, more close to the middle, the vote might become. You know, I do think we're losing a little bit of support around neutrality, because when you see sometimes how the polls are conducted, if people are asked out straight, do you support neutrality? I think it's such a central place of our value system that it comes out quite high. But then when the questions are twisted around and they're asked, you know, do you think we should participate in a larger defences, like an EU army, these kind of things, and they're framed in a more security way, I think that drops. You know, I think people support those things a little bit more. That when you make people afraid as well, that this is something that could happen here, I think that could have a big impact on a vote. So yeah, I just found it very difficult all week, I have to be honest.
Yeah, no, it's a thorny issue. You know, and you see the voices on it are very strong, and there's a lot of but in my sort of read of people in general, like I think, you know, it kind of goes back to that, well, what is actually possible point. Yeah. You know, because I think that people are proud of the fact that that we take a role. I think people are proud of the fact that we are rescuing people from drowning, you know, like that. And I suppose the question then, in terms of like Ireland's place in the world, you know, under neoliberal capitalism, it's that we're just a kind of lackey who runs around with the big boys, with an army and a navy that are totally you know, full of demotivated and underpaid and hardworking workers, you know.
Yeah, that's workers. But it's also, when we come back to the worker on the class question, it's like, who's profiting off this? Any kind of increase in NATO, any kind of increase in armed spending will just go to profiteers, as far as I'm concerned. I just don't trust under this system. Like, aside from the fact that I'm, you know, values are anti-war and that we should always be looking for peaceful solutions, and, you know, constantly pumping money into an arms industry is just the completely wrong way to go, it's that if this was a question of, let's increase our spending so that we can pay people more and give them good conditions and give them the resources they need to peacekeep, all day long I'd be for that. It's the fact that this money is inevitably going to go to profiteers. The money is going to go to, you know, it's going to go to arms profiteers, and it's going to go to the arms industry, which is has a vested interest in creating war. And we know how that has happened over the decades. Wars that are happening now are because groups were armed 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, by the opposite side. And I just think that we need more conversations with good faith actors to be able to have. And I don't trust that when this happens, that that's really going to be able to happen. Because what we're seeing now all the time, and I think the Ukraine war has really brought it to a head, is that it's very difficult for, if people try to have a conversation around NATO or try to have a conversation around the fear that, you know, will NATO actually do, you know, they push things forward, they're pushing towards war, they're not actually a defensive organization, that it's there's a vested interest there in the arms industry, and people accuse you of not caring about Ukrainian people, and it's this, they turn it into, bad faith actors turn it into a Russia-Ukraine thing, rather than we actually just want peace, we want as few people to be harmed around the world as possible. And I think that's a conversation that needs to be nuanced, and in a way that is very difficult to have when people don't genuinely want to have it, when people in positions of power don't genuinely
I have to say that, like, I'm a bit of reluctant into it, okay? So like I am, maybe it's just from being in Cork or something, like I don't know. You know, so I would say that I am an internationalist, but in terms of how one engages with discussions of geopolitics, because I find with geopolitical conversations, there's a lot of armchair kind of generals moving things around a map in countries that they don't really know anything that much about. And my general kind of experience is, you know, that is all fine and well. That is something that is happening. Of course, it's atrocious. It's atrocious when these things happen. Like, atrocities occur. Like, who actually gets harmed by all of this, really? Well, it's women and children. Like, it's older people. You know, like, and if you look at the people, who end up kind of having to get out of these places, like, it is, you know, women, children, older people, families, older men, like, you know, younger men, it's horrific, you know. But
and then young men left to die in wars, yeah, ultimately, as, yeah, well. So it's the displacement, it's the death, it's just, yeah, why we wouldn't be doing anything we can't avoid.
Well, you see, this is the reality of it, you know. This is the reality. And this is what essentially two capitalist countries are doing to one another, as far as I'm concerned. So I suppose when I think about questions like this, I think about, okay, well, I am in Ireland, so what is the Irish intervention here? So what I think about is, you know, well, how do we actually help in this situation? And of course, the first port of call is, well, we need to provide appropriate accommodation for the people who are ending up over here, which of course doesn't. When the war initially broke out, I made a point about, and I wrote to the Minister for Finance, actually, I wrote to Pascal Donoghue at the time, and said, you know, we facilitate Section 110 companies that actually are used to fund this outside of, you know, outside of the normal economy. So obviously we need to shut those down, shut down the loopholes that are being used actually by private people engaging in this war to fund it. That of course went straight in the shredder and was ignored. I got a reply back, but it was very much whatever. You know, and I suppose the last thing in that then is, what is the role that Ireland could play? What is the thing that we could be doing? It's currently not really possible for us actually to intervene, I suppose, because we don't have any capacity to do so. And we're not addressing any of the any of the issues that lead up to these conflicts. So, you know, I think that in the future, there will be a place for us actually to take more of a peacekeeping role, and take more of a radical role, I suppose, just in terms of addressing the insecurities that result in these things occurring in the first instance, which is usually to do with resources. You know, there's geopolitics, yeah, but there's also resources, yeah, and a lot of global conflict is fueled by issues with resources. And in this one, what has kind of emerged, of course, is energy. Energy is the reason why people intervene in the ways that they choose to, and food, that Ukraine was set up as
the breadbasket of Europe.
Yeah, but you know, again, then we're getting into kind of the geopolitics of it, because I mean, who exactly set up Ukraine like that? It's almost as if this is something that was a conflict that was going to happen for quite some time already. And now that we're in it, it's a case of, well, what is the best thing for people in Ukraine? Like, what is the best thing for them? And how do we intervene to actually provide that? And unfortunately, all of this, of course, is swept away in a conversation that basically boils down to the role of the Irish state, as far as it is concerned, is to open up new markets, you know. And in this case, and you know, there's always a trade-off for them doing that, you know. So with agribusiness, it's climate, they'll trade in climate to do that. You know, with tax havens, they'll trade off on, you know, public goods like infrastructure. For housing, you know, they'll trade in on, you know, people having somewhere to live. All of the people who are being evicted now have been traded in, you know, by the Irish state. And in this case, you know, this opening up a new market here, a market of conflict and war, is trading the lives of working class people. That's what's happened. That's the only option that they can think of, and they can paint it in whatever words that they want. Like the actual class politics of it is that the state wishes to open up a new market in, you know, anything to do with war, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah. The token that they will trade in to get that, in this instance, is the lives of working class people.
Yeah, exactly. We're keeping on security slightly. I've one last story before. I don't know if you have anything else to jump in after this, but then I do have a good news story to end on, which we try to do, but we don't always get the opportunity to do.
Okay, good.
I'll just touch on this briefly. So basically, you know, there's a bill gone through, a justice bill gone through about body cams for the Gardaí that's been kind of going on for a couple of years, and it went through pre-legislative scrutiny, and it went through all the usual markers in the doll and the shannon. But there's an amendment being made to include facial recognition software in the body cam, and there's been numerous opposition, you know, within the Justice Committee from another Green Party in government. I think the only government party to oppose, a lot of opposition. And Drew Harris has come out and said, like, it's absolutely mandatory. But I just think the idea of facial recognition software, it's so problematic as it is, because we've seen in other countries it's banned in some countries. And then you see places like the US where it's completely misused. There's incredible bias inside, and it really infringes on people's privacy rights. Never mind, you know, when it's used in an exploitative way. At its most basic, it's infringing on people's privacy rights. But the idea that a piece of legislation that is this impactful at a time when, you know, there's conversations around surveillance and artificial intelligence and the kind of speed at which these things are evolving, that something like this could be included after pre-legislative scrutiny. So there's not going to be any scrutiny on this. There's not going to be any conversations around it. It's just extraordinary, I think. And I mean, I know you have a lot of experience within legislation and tracking it.
This was like good that, news.
No, this isn't the good news story. No, okay. This is the one last one before. Definitely not good news. I mean, if you come from a community like mine, the idea that the guards are going to have facial recognition software on top of, you know, when you hear a body cam, you'd like to think that they'd be used to protect people. I come from a community that has experienced huge violence from the Gardaí. Like, you know, I myself have witnessed so much of it. So the idea that piece of, you know, equipment or software could be used in a way that's going to be even more oppressive, I find really problematic. But even more back to a legislative piece, it's that the idea that anything this impactful can go through the Dáil without pre-legislative scrutiny is just such a problem.
Oh,
for
no,
me.
It's you know, I would say it's utterly bizarre. But then you see again, like, I'm not surprised. I'm just shrugging here, just putting my hands up in the air and shrugging, because you know, I think part of what we have seen with the response to the spice bag stuff over the last week as well, you know, is or sorry, maybe 2 weeks ago. I'm losing track of time. No, there's, I mean, like, it goes again to kind of the role of the Gardaí. So, like, are they there for, you know, the public, public good, social purpose, or are they there basically to enforce things as they are? And yes, they do actually target working class communities more than anyone else, you know, and the various intersections of working class and workers and carers. So yeah, you know, that to me is kind of, well, of course the government would try to just not scrutinize the role of the Gardaí because they don't like to be scrutinized. And to be honest, the reason why they don't like to be scrutinized is because very often it doesn't bear scrutiny.
I mean, we've seen reports from within the guards themselves about, for instance, being institutionally racist. I mean, like, there's like they themselves submitted a report that showed institutional racism there. And I think that anytime that scrutiny does happen, it's not very positive. But if we're going to have forums, you know, on the future of policing and things like that, they're willing to have those conversations. I just find it outrageous. It's such an insult to the idea of democracy from the people who are supposed to be the upholders of democracy that they know they have the numbers to get a bill through. So it's like it's like saying we don't care about the free legislative side. We don't care about the committees. We don't actually value those things if we're going to put probably one of the most contentious pieces and the most contentious amendments in right at the end, because we know it'll pass anyway. And I find there's two pieces there. There is the Gardaí and the fact that you saw, like, listen, we saw it with Fionn Sheehan. We saw it with people, the kind of the opinion writer class almost, that how dare you criticize the Gardaí, when in reality, any organization that has the kind of power, the power to take away your freedom, the power to like physically violate you in the way the Gardaí can, you know, like we see videos all the time. Like there is a story actually this week about a guard facing charges for assault on a 17-year-old because of an incident that happened during COVID. Some really violent videos came out during COVID. And what we do is, instead of people saying, okay, that's really bad, these people have an increased level of power than the ordinary citizen, let's make sure that that's handled in the right way, that people have the right training, that their values at the, you know, the center of the guards are right. The response is automatically, you know, guards defend us, the guards protect us, that as if that should mean that they're above scrutiny. So that's a really problematic thing just on a societal level. And people then, you get this real divisive people bringing up times guards have been killed in the line of duty. And that just shuts down conversation, because nobody's going to disagree that they are absolutely horrific things to happen, that they're workers that are facing, you know, that are their lives are taken in the line of duty. So I mean, nobody's going to disagree with that. And it just shuts down conversation. And I think that we definitely need to have a conversation around that, around the guards and being able to scrutinize any organization or group of people that have a disproportionate amount of power over anybody else. So there should always be scrutiny. And then there's the legislative piece. I just think it's outrageous. And it just shows how much of a mockery sometimes the Dáil is. You know, we see it all the time. Like they have the power to get it through. They have the numbers. And sometimes that's all that matters. And then we see the kind of, we saw it with the eviction ban with like Nessa Horgan and things like that, that all the stories become about the kind of the Punch and Judy aspect of what goes on in the circusness of it all, rather than the things that are going to impact people's everyday lives. But
because I mean, like there's a really good article in buzz.ie by Louise Byrne and Ethna Dodd. And it goes through the whole issue of the facial record technology, you know, so I really like articles like that. I also, their environment stuff lately as well has been very good. I'm liking what they're doing. That's a thumbs up from me. The problem with all of these things is that, again, you'll have Green Party sources say that there is, you know, oh, it's we're very unhappy, very unhappy. But you see, is anybody going to actually leave the party as a result of this? No.
And are they going to vote for it?
Are they going to do anything? No. Well, see, this is it. So, I mean, like, I think that I'm reading through this one, like the fact that there are so few actually name quotes from Green Party members. It's always a Green Party source or you know, always a Green Party TD or councillor. But nobody is ever willing to just put their name to something. So that means that they're not actually willing to stand by it.
Yeah.
And the purpose of these quotes then is just a virtue signal. It's just to say, oh, well, you know, well, we did disagree with it. But anyway, we did vote for it as well, in order to continue doing the massive climate damage that we are doing, not just on a national but global scale, you know. Thanks, Mark Ruffalo. Thank you for that. cheers, mate.
I would love to know what Mark Ruffalo thinks right now, the Irish contribution to climate, or the Green Party contribution to climate destruction. Okay, so it's depressing. As depressing as all that is, we do have a good news story to end on, and that's the fact that after over 40 years of campaigning and numerous protests, numerous reports, numerous campaigns, numerous letdowns, Stardust inquest starts tomorrow. So the jury selection starts tomorrow, and obviously you might not imagine it's your normal typical happy story, because it's going to be a really difficult process. My mom is going to be a witness and get to actually speak for the first time properly outside her own Garda statements about her own experience and the friends that she lost and her own injuries and the impact of that on her whole life. And every single family that lost somebody has been spending the last couple of months going through the details of how they died, going through their own pen portraits of the person. That's going to be the start of the inquest in a couple of weeks. But as bittersweet as it's going to be, and as difficult as it's going to be for a lot of people, this is the first time I think people really believe it's going to happen. You know, this is access to justice in a very real way. And there's a lot of people have a lot of faith. The coroner has been really brilliant up to now. The families have put so much work in. You know, there's people going to be traveling down. It's going to be a really long process. It's going to be it's the largest inquest in the history of the state. And there's been so much public support for the families in Stardust for, over four decades now. I think there's a huge amount of people invested. I used to go around when we had the campaign at the start with postcards. I'd bring them everywhere with me and I'd hand them out in the park for people to, sign them so we could give them to the Attorney General. But almost every single person, bar maybe a couple of tourists, genuinely knew and had their own story about the Stardust. They knew somebody who was there. They were supposed to be there that night. Obviously, North Dublin, where I am, it's going to be like that. But it's a massive day. And it's, it's a day that I don't think a lot of people ever thought that we'd get to. So it is a good news story. As bittersweet as it's going to be, it's a really good news story. And it shows the power of campaigning. And people this is what the Irish state does. The Irish state almost waits for people to die. We've seen it with the mother and baby homes, seeing it up north as well with some of the processes and the inquests that's happened up there. But and a lot of people have passed away. There's a lot of people that aren't going to be here. My nana isn't going to be here, who was involved in the campaign from a very early stage. I have videos of her at public meetings. And, there's parents, mothers and fathers who lost children who aren't going to be there. And some of these have passed away in the past couple of years since the inquest has been announced. So there's been delay after delay. It is what the Irish state does. But it just shows the power, the people power of just not giving up and refusing to accept, a lack of justice. And so tomorrow we're going to see the very start of the inquest, and it'll go on for a while, and we'll cover it on the show, and I'll keep everybody updated. But it is going to be a long process, but it's a bittersweet, but it's a good news story.
It's going to be a very difficult time, for everyone involved. But at the end of the day, it's wrestled the Irish state to the mat, and you had to keep doing. So it's bittersweet, as you say. I hope that there will be closure and that there will be accountability after it. But anything that has been gotten already is because of your work. And I think that it's always important to, in any campaign, actually to take those moments when you've actually gotten something across the line, and just kind of feel that, that you've done that,
But there's people who have, there's families who have not stopped for over 40 years. It's absolutely incredible. I don't know how they've had the commitment that they've had, as in to be able to just keep going after so many setbacks. But I've constantly had a fear leading up to this, that what if it is another letdown? Because just the power of that and the fear around that is massive. But I know, and it's very different for the likes of my family, because, and certainly the likes of me, because my focus is my mum. And I want her to be able to sit up there and tell her story and her experience, and to be told and acknowledged that her life had value and all their lives had value. And they were because growing up, it was so clear to us that how they were treated afterwards was so badly. It took them years. They had to fight for years for every little scrap of support that they got. My mom was brought into a basketball hall and told to strip while men just looked from halfway down the hall to decide what our injuries were worth. Just absolutely horrific, inhumane treatment. But I was told, my mom and Anna, family, I knew from a very young age that if we weren't a working class family, people wouldn't have been treated in the way they were. But yeah, listen, it is a brilliant story.
Yes.
Brilliant. And hopefully we have a great outcome at the end of it. But I think we'll wrap up there and let you head off for your Sunday. But thanks so much for coming today, Lauren. This has been great. And thanks everybody for listening. This has been The Week at Work. The Week at Work is a member of Left Block. That's Left Block with a C. You can find us on leftblock.ie and across our socials. And if you'd like to support, we're a political education and media platform. And if you'd like to support us on Patreon, you can find us at patreon.com/leftblock. And that's Left Block with a C again. And we have a couple of other podcasts. We have Trademark Belfast. We have the ABCs of Green Politics. And we have Noon and Og, an Irish language podcast as well. And we have a media platform on the website where you'll find articles and stories and news. So that's us, and hopefully catch you next week, folks.
See you. Bye.